When somebody says it's predatory, they immediately told me they've never tried this before.
Pace Morby.
Pace Morby is the guy for all things real estate.
With over $500 million in real estate in his portfolio.
He's known for his innovative strategies in the real estate industry.
And he does it all with something called creative financing.
I invite people, come hang out with me on a Thursday. Let's go on a seller appointment. You talk to the seller that hugs me, cries that I'm the only person that ever solved their problem. An agent couldn't solve their problem. Wholesalers couldn't solve their problem. A loan modification couldn't solve their problem. Subject to is the only solution for them.
Tribe listeners, I have an extremely exciting announcement for all of you. Do you want to come hang out with Cody Sanchez, David Osborne, David Green, Rich Roll, and even yours truly down in Austin, Texas? Well, let's do it. May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, for the first time ever, GoBundance, the exclusive millionaire membership group, is opening up an event to anyone, man, woman, millionaire, or not, and we're calling it the Austin Entrepreneurial Summit. At the AES, you'll meet all those people I mentioned, plus GoBundance members on both the men's and women's side, and I'll be there hanging out the entire time. Every event I've ever attended for GoBundance has given me a disproportionate return on the money spent and the time spent to get there. And this is the biggest one that GoBundance has ever done. So if you're a member, not a member, and you're looking to supercharge the second part of your year 2024, this event in May is a great way to get that all kickstarted. Go to GoBundance.com/AES right now for early bird pricing for members and guests. And warning, the power of GoBundance events is that it holds you accountable long after you're gone to achieving whatever goals you've set. So this event will change your life. GoBundance.com/AES. I'll see you there. Let's get back to the show. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Tribe of Millionaires podcast. My name is Jamie Gruber, and my guest today, Pace Morby, is one of the most creative real estate investors on the planet with over $500 million in real estate in his portfolio. He's well known for being the go-to expert for subject to, and he's the host of A&E's Triple Digit Flip. He's also the best-selling author of Wealth Without Cash, which you can find on Bigger Pockets, Amazon, or anywhere for that matter. Pace, man, thanks for jumping on today.
Brother, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I want to start a little different than maybe you're used to. Just to kind of, let's dig in a bit. This is on a personal note, an interesting fact about you. So you're one of 12 kids.
One of 12 kids, yeah, number three.
Yep. You're number three. What is being number three of 12? How does that show up? How did that inform who you are today? How does that show up as who you are today?
I'm number one, a foundational element in my life is helping other people. And it was because I had nine siblings underneath me. And so I wake up in the morning, I'm like, all right, who needs help? What diaper needs to be changed? Who needs to be dropped up at school? You know, I was basically a built-in nanny for my parents once I got to a certain age. And so I still do the same thing. I wake up in the morning, I'm like, all right, who can I help? And it's, I think, programmed the way my brain works.
It's interesting. So a lot of your stories you tell when you started in this business of creative finances about the Flemish rabbits, which you always say Google, and I did, and they are freaking huge. They're ridiculously big. Yeah. But that story was you essentially going into your first deal and finding a way to add value. This lady's issue was she had these three rabbits she needed to do something with, and you solved that problem for her. And then later, there's a really interesting story on a multifamily property where you identified, I think the seller's pain was that his 12-year-old son was jealous of the property, right? So you had this, you had these two things, and you figured out a way to solve it. I tend to be the guy that walks away from anything, situations, muttering to myself, damn it, I should have said this, I should have said that. Is your ability in the moment, I always wonder this about guys like you, Grant Cardone as well, I had him on and I asked him the same question. Is your ability in the moment to be nimble enough to have the solution ready or a solution ready, is that teachable? Or is that innate?
It's a little bit of both. Innate me is the part of it that is innate is the level of care I have for that person and that I don't want to give up because nothing to do with the deal. I just don't want to give up in the sense that I could have found a solution. And so I'll grind and grind and grind and call a seller that might even be under contract still with somebody else saying, hey, we're going to go a different direction. I'll continue to call that seller and go, well, what about this solution? And what about that solution? And they're like, Pace, we're already under contract with somebody else. Yeah, I know you are. But I really want to know if this would have solved your problem. I just really, really have that level of care of trying to figure that out. And then secondly, I've had thousands of meetings with sellers where I've walked away saying I could have done better. And what I did, very, very happy I did this. Starting from day one, 10 years ago, when I got into the business, I recorded every single seller call that I had in their living room, every single seller call. Even if I'm standing in the carport of a property, I've got my phone on record, like a voice memo, so that I could drive home 45 minutes and re-listen to the conversation and go, I should have paused. I should have done this. And I really am my worst critic, but I do it very intentionally so that I have less and less of those moments over time.
So reps, you put in reps. That's interesting. Calling sellers, not trying to get them out from under the contract that they're in, but to see what else could have potentially solved their issue.
Yeah, that's actually started for my wife. When my wife jumped into my business, this is like year one, I was going out meeting with homeowners and I'd get sometimes 2-3 contracts in a day. Not every day, but there were days where I would get 2 or 3 contracts. And I was also a contractor simultaneously. So I'd throw the contracts in the back of the truck like contractors do. And I'm like, all right, I'll go open escrow with those tomorrow. My wife would come in and go, hey, you know, you had 3 appointments today. How'd they go? I'm like, oh, I contracted them. She's like, where are the contracts? Did you open escrow? I'm like, no, I'll do it tomorrow. She's like, Pace, you can't do that. Like, let me get involved. Let me be your transaction coordinator. So my wife jumps in, you know, kind of cleaning up my paperwork, disorganization. And she starts doing also my follow-up. But the way she did my follow-up, I did not coach her on this. She started doing my follow-ups on appointments that I lost out on. So she would track the MLS. So let's say I go to 123 Main Street in March. In April, she would notice that they sold to somebody else on the MLS. And she would call them and go, hey, my husband met with you in March. Looks like you've already sold to such and such investment company. I just wanted to know, what could my husband have done better?
Wow.
Oh my gosh, bro. Like the feedback I got from those conversations where the house was already sold. And so there was no way for me to unravel that transaction. They absolutely knew that my wife was not trying to be conniving or, you know, get in between and create a wedge between the buyer and the seller. They were so brutally honest and it was so helpful. We'd sit down, she'd scratch these things out, you know, notes like, do this better. My biggest problem, you want to know what the funniest thing was?
What did you identify? Yeah, go for it.
The number one thing was that I didn't do my follow-up. That was it. So we'd get sellers that would say, oh, thank you, Laura. Yeah. I remember your husband. He was awesome. We really wanted to do business with him. He said he was going to follow up in 12 hours, but he followed up in like 20 hours. So between hour 12 and hour 20, we decided to go with somebody else. And by the time your husband finally called on hour 20, we just basically ignored his call because what's the point of telling him that we went with somebody else? We don't know him from Adam. So we don't feel like we owed him anything. And she was like, Pace, you cannot do what you do in your construction business, which is you get overwhelmed, you get busy, you're not delegating important tasks. And so you get to really important things really, really late. Not that I don't get them done, I just got them late. And these homeowners, they need somebody to be consistent. They need somebody to show up. They know there's something going on. Same thing with apartment building owners. I just bought a $20 million apartment complex on seller finance. I can tell you how we got that as well. And how we won that contract is very similar to that exact process, which is showing up, doing what you said you were going to do and actually doing it earlier. So what I started doing differently is if I told the seller, I'll follow up in 24 hours, I started following up in 12. And I started under-promising, over-delivering, instead of over-promising, under-delivering. And it seems really, really common sense. It's just not common practice. You don't think it's that big of a deal. But when the homeowner's sitting in their home and they're talking to their wife or spouse, and they're trying to make a decision on who to sell the house to, they're going to go with the person that they can rely on the most. And I was obviously not reliable. In my mind, it's only 6 hours. In their mind, 6 hours is everything.
That's incredible. Thanks for sharing that. That's really, really cool. I want to dive into subject to versus seller financing. Let's start there. Can you delineate the two?
Yes. Subject to means there's already an existing mortgage or debt on the thing. And I say the thing because I can talk about it with a house. I can talk about it with a business. I can talk about it with a vehicle, an airplane, whatever the thing is that you're trying to buy. I look at, let's say a business. We're in the process of buying an excavation company right now. And the excavation company has an SBA loan, right? They got an SBA loan, they started the company, and all I'm doing is I'm coming in and taking over the payments on that SBA loan. Instead of me going and getting an SBA loan to pay off an SBA loan, why would I do that? That doesn't make any sense. Why don't I just ask the seller, hey, instead of me going and getting a new loan where they make money and then your lender makes money and there's all this money exchanging hands and you're not getting of that benefit, why don't you just let me do this transaction way faster? I'll just take over your SBA loan and sell the business to me a lot quicker. So when there's an existing loan in place and I just step in and start taking over those payments, that's called subject to. I'm buying the business, buying the house, buying the airplane, buying the car, subject to the existing debt that's already in place. I'm not qualifying for it. I'm not calling the bank and getting permission because I don't need it. And I'm not using credit. I'm not using credentials. It's literally the cheat code, in my opinion, of real estate is subject to.
Well, on that
seller
business,
finance.
Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
Seller finance means there is no debt. right? We've got another business we bought last year. I know this is primarily a real estate podcast, but there was a business I bought last year doing $5 million a year in revenue. He has zero debt whatsoever. And we came in and through consulting, we took over 50% of the business through a seller finance note, and he has no debt. So I'm not having to pay off debt. I'm not having to go get a new loan. The seller and us can now work out a private agreement because there's no banks and there's no debt. So when there's a debt in place, subject to, when there's no debt in place, you can work out an agreement directly with the seller, then it is seller finance.
Yeah. Just so you know, too, we have equal parts business buyers, real estate buyers, personal brands. We did about 170,000 downloads last month. We got it all. So everything you are, everything you do is so, so relevant. So we can dive into all of it.
Cool.
On the business that you talked about, when you went subject to, so you took over the SBA debt. I get that. Why would you? Why would you pay off one loan with another loan? But what about the equity? Are you buying the equity out of that business? Is that how that works in the subject to transaction?
Yeah, so that we call that a hybrid. So that's a phrase I came up with about 10 years ago because in the ethos of real estate, nobody was calling that anything because nobody was really doing it 10 years ago, at least anybody that had a brand. And so it's part subject to, right? The SBA loan, I'm taking it subject to. So that particular deal, we're buying for $2 million. There's an SBA loan for $1 million. So about half of the business and the worth of the business is tied up in a loan. The other half, the seller's like, I'm retiring, so just make me a monthly payment. The way that's cool is that seller with the $1 million of equity he has, he's actually going to stay on board with us for 18 months as he navigates relationships and hands relationships off to us because he's kind of a good old boy. He built all these relationships by handshakes and face-to-face relationships. So he's staying on board for 18 months. We're going to put some head of operations underneath him, shadow him for 18 months. Once he leaves is when our payment starts to him. Mm. And that payment to him is $12,000 a month for 10 years. And then after the 10 years, we refinance him all the way out with a new loan or pay him off in cash.
Got it. On my end, going over to the real estate side, I'm more familiar. I've never purchased a business. I've started businesses and I've purchased real estate. On the real estate side, I've heard you talk about, you know, people always ask about, okay, you're taking over the mortgage on a subject to for X property. There's the due on sale clause. I've heard you talk about that as having happened, but also being the boogeyman. Can you describe that? What do you mean by, yes, due on sale clause will happen? Well, I guess maybe what is it? It does happen. And then what do you mean by it's the boogeyman then?
It's the boogeyman. I'll start from there. I'm not a licensed real estate agent or a broker, nor would I ever be just based on what I do. There is benefit in doing it, but the only people that ever bring up due on sale clause and acceleration clause, which are the same thing, just called two different things in different states, are licensed brokers and real estate agents that somebody told them to worry about it. I'm like, but they didn't tell you how to overcome it. They didn't tell you actually what it was. And they didn't tell you the statistics and how often it happens. And they didn't tell you that it's actually not illegal or any of the, like, I didn't teach you any of the actual important things. And so when somebody comes to me and goes, what about the due on sale clause? I go, oh, you must be a licensed broker that's actually never done any of this stuff. And that's the only thing anybody ever taught you. What the due on sale clause is let's say I'm taking over a house. I've got a property. Somebody in the audience can, I hope I have skeptics. I love skeptics, by the way.
We're going to have some. Yeah.
I love them. I love them because every time I get a skeptic, I go, all right, jump in my van with me. Every Thursday, I take random people, about 10 people every Thursday around with me in a van. I go show them my properties. They meet my attorney. They meet my title company. They, you know, they go to my building. They see my organization. They see that I'm not just some guy working out of his home, which is what it looks like. And I show them all of the documentation and the legalities around all of this stuff. And they walk. I've never had a person within an hour of a 10-hour day with me go, holy crap, I was so wrong. So if you are a skeptic listening to what we're talking about, and we'll get into more of the stuff that people don't like about Sub 2, come hang out with me. Send me a DM on Instagram and come hang out with me. And I will, in 45 minutes, you will go, I was wrong about everything. But what due on sale clause is I've got a property, 4101 West Flower Street in Phoenix, Arizona. Flower Street is a property I bought, tried to go with the agent. The agent had it listed on the market for 6 months. They failed to sell it. This happens all the time, by the way. They're called expired listings. There's 15,000 real estate agents every day that get fired for not selling a house over a 6 month time frame. I don't know. A lot of people don't know that 15,000 agents a day get fired in the United States for not being able to sell a house for 6 months. Okay. 15,000 new expired listings pop up every day. Okay. Every day, not every month, every day. So this week, okay, this week we will have 75,000 expired listings across the country. So guys, when somebody tells you, oh, we have an inventory problem. No, we don't. We have a creative problem. People are not very creative. So this house on Flower goes expired. We call the seller directly. His name is Bruce. Hey, Bruce, my name's Pace. Saw that agent wasn't able to sell your house. I'm not an agent. I'm actually a buyer. And I'd like to just send you an offer of taking over your payments. Bruce says, You would do that? Yeah, I would do that, Bruce. We do it all the time. Oh my gosh, how much do I have to pay you? It's such a paradigm shift when you actually get into this business, you understand the pain of the seller. Most of the sub two deals I have, people are begging us to take over their house because we know how to identify these situations. So Bruce says, you would do that? Okay, and I don't have to pay you any money? No. So we get the property under contract through a regular purchase and sale agreement with sub two addendums attached to it, open escrow at a title company, go through a title company, we get a title report, we go through, we close escrow, gets recorded at the county recorder's office, just like any other transaction. I get title insurance on every single sub two that I do. It is passed off by a title company's in, obviously we're getting title report. They're walking through the paperwork. We're obviously doing it legally. Otherwise they wouldn't give us title insurance. But what the due on sale clause is let's say 2 months later, which is what happened here, the lender on 4101 West Flower Street, they go, oh my gosh, Bruce just sold this house to Pace, but he didn't pay us off in the transaction. So they send you a letter and they say, we want to know what the heck is going on. And you have 35 days to reply. You go, okay, hey, just so you know, yes, we did sell the property. Yes, he did sell the property to us. And no, we did not pay you off. Here's the transaction we did. Here's the copy of the servicing agreement. Here's how I'm making payments. And yes, I'm the new owner. The bank replies and goes, okay, thank you. And they go away. That's 99% of the time. But the due on sale clause is where the bank says, we want the house to be paid off, or we're going to foreclose on you to take the house back because you sold the property without paying us off. So does the due on sale clause happen? Yes. We've done 10,000 plus transactions, these sub two deals. I have personally seen it happen 10 times. I've never in my life, and I challenge anybody else, you DM me, you show me somebody that's actually lost a home to the due on sale clause, and I'll show you somebody that did subject two wrong. I've never seen somebody that did this properly, or anybody for that matter. I've never once seen somebody lose a house to the due on sale clause one time.
Nor have I. It's an interesting point. You're right. It is sort of that talking point, like, oh, you know, this is in the language, right? Oh my gosh. Then I shouldn't take action is sort of the implication of that. Right?
Yeah. And I think it's mostly brokers are afraid of maybe, you know, losing their license or something along those lines. But when you actually sit down with an attorney that's been in the business for 30 or 40 years and they understand the law and they understand and they've been involved in due on sale clause, oh my gosh, I've got the biggest list of the IRS shows you how to take a property subject to. There's a settlement, there's a line on a HUD that shows you exactly to check the box that you're buying a house subject to. Every single state, as a licensed real estate agent, you can go into your documents and you can pull a sub to addendum in every single state. It is not just legal. It is commonly done. It's been done over 100 years. And so the whole due on sale clause thing is when people actually bring up the due on sale clause to me, as if it's a valid concern to them, in my mind, I go, you're a clown. You have not actually educated yourself. Somebody else told you about this and you know nothing about the subject matter. However, I don't think I've been on a podcast where somebody has not brought it up.
Yeah. Well, so I'm a clown.
No. I'm saying when somebody brings it up to me in their mind, they think, oh, this is a really valid concern. I'm not going to take any action because I'm really afraid of this. Now, if you want to get nitty gritty, there's a whole other level of education that people need. I don't know if this is going to bore your audience or not, but you can always do, if you're afraid of the due on sale clause, there's a solution to this. It's called an executory contract. Every state has them. States call them different things. Some states call them land contracts, contracts for deeds, bond for deed. I'm sure you've heard of these phrases. If you want to take over somebody's mortgage, take over even a commercial building, people in commercial real estate think they're the most intelligent human beings on the planet. So they'll say stuff like, nope, commercial, you can do this in single family because that's for children. But in multifamily, these commercial lenders, they're watching the property like a hawk. And I don't disagree. I think you're right. So why don't you just take the property through a contract for deed or a land contract where the deed does not actually transfer into the new owner's name. The deed is signed off by the original owner, and the deed then sits in a safety deposit box until the borrower or the buyer does what he says he's going to do, which is I'm going to perform, I'm going to refinance and get you out of this. When that refinance happens, the deed then will transfer. Or you can say, hey, I'm going to pay you off in cash, then I'll get the deed. But a contract for deed is the solution to commercial real estate buying it subject to.
Makes sense. The skepticism, I think, and I've got a little of this, I'm curious, more than skeptical maybe, or maybe both, but let's dive. So to your point, I don't think there's any, well, at least for this audience, the people that are probably listening, there's no doubt that you are able to go the subject to route. Like it's legal. It's not, you know, it's available in any state. There's a few different principles though I wanted to dive into that I think we can clear up probably. So first is insurance. So let me just make sure I understand this and I'll explain it in the most basic terms I can. You tell me where I'm wrong, but I find a property or piece of real estate. I have an agreement with the seller that we're going to go subject to. So I take possession of the deed. Doesn't necessarily mean I transfer the deed. I own the deed. You talk a lot about this, the receipt in the grocery store. Like I have the receipt in the grocery store, which means I own it. That's the proof of ownership. It doesn't need to be filed anywhere. You have possession of a signed deed. It's yours. The owner, though, holds the debt, or the seller, excuse me, holds the debt still. It's still their mortgage. I'm assuming it's still their insurance policy. In the event of suffering an insurance loss, are you as the holder of the deed, the owner, are you listed as an additional interest on that insurance policy, or do you need to be? The key to life, it isn't money. It's happiness. And when you measure how happy you are, you actually become even more happy. Our friends at GoBundance, the tribe of millionaires, use a very specific tool to measure their happiness. It's called the Life Happiness Index. And you can have it too. Go over to GoBundance.com/LHI and take your Life Happiness Index assessment. You'll rate yourself in multiple categories on exactly how happy you are and get a custom output for you specifically that you can use in developing whatever goals you have for your life. GoBundance is the tribe of healthy, wealthy, generous people who choose to live epic lives. And the tool GoBundance members use at the base of all of that is the Life Happiness Index. Get out there and grab life big.
Such a great question. So there's a company we use called sub2insurance.com. They do all of our insurance. This is what they do. Yes, it's sub2insurance.com. I know it's crazy. So when I close escrow, I actually have two policies in place. Okay. I have the original policy in place where the seller is the main insured and I am added as the additional insured before we close escrow. Then and then I also buy another policy myself. That policy is me as the main insured and adding the seller as the additional insured. Why? Because I want full control of that insurance policy. If a check is distributed, let's say there's a flood, you know, one of my tenants has a hot water heater that bursts and I've got a $100,000 claim that I need a check. I want to be the main person that gets contacted on that. So what we do is we get a second policy. About 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks after we close escrow, the gentleman at sub2insurance.com, what they do is they then call the mortgage company and they swap out the insurance policies and they cancel the one where the seller is the main insured. And that's, we carry one policy going forward and that policy is me, the main insured. Seller is now named as the additional insured on that policy.
That answers my second question. If you have two policies, the issue of primacy, which policy is first, which policy is second. So you're saying sub2insurance will call the mortgage company and swap it out in advance of filing the loss?
No, they swap it out within a week of me closing escrow. Has nothing to do with the loss.
The seller keeps insurance on the property up until escrow is closed, then it's swapped out.
Correct.
Got it. Have you had any losses filed and have had any issues as a result?
Yeah, I had a loss 8 years ago before I learned how to do the insurance properly. I just thought, oh, this isn't going to happen. The seller's going to, even if there is a challenging thing that happens to the property, there's a claim. The seller and I were great friends through the transaction. Why would the seller not receive a check and then send it back to me? Well, I learned the hard way. Seller received a $75,000 check for a claim that we made against the property on a hot water heater. Flooded. It went from the second floor down. It was in Texas. A lot of people don't know this, but Texas has their hot water heaters in their attic. It's the dumbest thing ever. So property, the floods, claim, $75,000 goes to the homeowner. We finally get the homeowner to go, yeah, I do have the $75,000 check, but I want half the money. And I'm like, all right. So I go to an attorney. I go, how can I never have this problem ever again? And so we came up with our own process and the way that now everybody in the country now does insurance swap on sub-2 insurance came from me and my attorney.
Is it more costly than a standard home policy, something like sub-2 insurance?
About the same. My policy is actually really, really inexpensive now. I have an umbrella policy for my entire portfolio.
Sure.
And so I can add and take properties off my, it, way complicated conversation. But,
oh, but the umbrella is more liability, right? So that takes care of
No. I've got one policy for all my entire single family portfolio going forward. We got rid of every individual policy. What I used to do is I would have an individual policy on every property. And then on that LLC, let's say I have 10 properties in that LLC, I would then have an umbrella policy on top of that LLC just in case so that insurance would never go outside of it. So my family office, they came in there, they restructured that whole thing. Not a great conversation for us, you and I, to get into because most people won't get value from it. But when I first started, yes, my insurance probably is 5-7% more expensive having that policy because now it's a landlord policy rather than a homeowner policy.
Negligible.
The policy does go up.
Yeah, negligible though. It's not like it's double the price or anything.
No. Yeah. I mean, dang. I mean, insurance in Texas and Florida, my insurance in those properties, regardless of what the heck I'm doing with the insurance policy, I'm getting hammered on insurance policies lately. A lot of people are. In fact, I just saw BiggerPockets just did a whole podcast about why insurance is hiking up. So insurance is going to go up regardless, but you just got to underwrite it properly going, okay, I'm going to close escrow. I'm going to have a recording number. This property is going to be mine. The county recorder is going to see that we transferred the ownership of the property. They're going to reassess this at some point in the next 18 months, depending on the state you're in. My property taxes are going to go up and my insurance is going to go up as well. You have to put that into your underwriting numbers.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Another piece of skepticism, this gets into like, is it predatory is probably the word for it. So you acquire this house from a seller, they still hold the debt. So their DTI is impacted by that. They now, 5 years later, they get themselves in a better situation. 2 years later, a year later, whatever it is, they want to go buy a house. And this is now impacting their ability to buy another home for them to go live in, or a condo or whatever it is. How do you work around that? Or have you had that situation pop up?
I've had that a situation pop up 400 times. I've never not gotten around it. And when people say stuff like it's predatory, we could talk about that for a second. Let me put
Please.
That to the side. Actually, let's talk about that for a second. When somebody says it's predatory, they immediately told me they've never tried this before.
True.
That's what you've told me. Not you, obviously, but
No, but you're right. That is everybody that says it's like, I don't like it. Something feels really bad about it. You're taking advantage of sellers. It's predatory. I'm not going
to. I invite people, come hang out with me on a Thursday. Let's go on a seller appointment. You talk to the seller that hugs me, cries that I'm the only person that ever solved their problem. An agent couldn't solve their problem. Wholesalers couldn't solve their problem. A loan modification couldn't solve their problem. Subject to was the only solution to them. These people text me 5 years, 7 years, 8 years later. I saw you had a new brand new baby. Here's a blanket I knitted for you. That's the average seller in a subject to transaction, because subject to solves a painful situation, right? I'm not going to a homeowner typically that is going to sell their house subject to me, and I'm not solving a massive problem that nobody else could solve. Subject to truly is not, hey, let me convince you not to list your property and instead sell your house to me subject to. That is not the demographic. The demographic is primarily people who have gone through expired six months of trying to sell with an agent. Okay. I think agents are predatory. I personally, because I can make, here's the argument. I would love to have a head-to-head battle against one of the top agents in your podcast, and I would whoop their ass. Here's the argument. I think a lot of agents are predatory. Why? Because they go to school for 2 weeks. They know jack all about real estate. A barber goes to school literally 12 times more hours than a real estate agent who's going to sell a homeowner's largest asset goes to school. They go to school for less than 100 hours. Somebody cutting your hair goes to school for 1,200 hours. You tell me what the hell is wrong with that, okay? So agents don't know how to comp in real estate school. But then the second you get out of real estate school, your broker's like, all right, go to your sphere of influence. Ask people who can sell their house. You, who has no experience, are going to go list somebody's home. How do you even know what to list that property for? You have no idea how to value property. So what happens with 15,000 expired listings every day, for me, is an agent that took a listing they should not have taken, or an agent that took a listing without educating their seller properly and saying, hey, you have unrealistic expectations on your sales price, but you know what? Doesn't matter. I'm just going to take the listing because I need a commission, and I'm just going to throw this bad boy on the market and see what happens. That's predatory, in my opinion. I think you should be going to your homeowner and saying, hey, homeowner, you have five other options besides listing on the property or listing on the market. The value of the property is 400. You want 480. I'm probably not the right agent for you. You can go take another agent that's an idiot. It's going to end up having an expired listing in 6 months. You need to list at 400 or else I'm not signing a listing with you. That is the ethical way to do it. What they're doing is they just blindly take a listing because their broker told them to do it, and they only have 100 hours of classroom experience, no actual real world experience. And then people like me are the ones that come and clean up the mess. So, you know, there's arguments on both sides of the predatory stuff. Sub two, I have never one time done a sub two deal where that property should have been listed and sold on the retail market. Never one time. It is not the same demographic of seller. It's not even remotely close. I'm solving a foreclosure. I'm solving expired listing. I'm solving somebody who has no equity. I'm solving somebody who has a situation going on. There's never been a time where I bought a property subject to and the seller's not thanking me for taking their house over. Never one time has that happened. Now, let's go to the DTI. The argument on the DTI is basically, let me make this argument. If I'm a landlord on BiggerPockets, right? I'm watching BiggerPockets. I'm watching all their stuff. I go do the BRRRR strategy and I have now refinance. I go buy a property. I use hard money. I'm using my credit like a knucklehead. I then go through the process. I refinance once my tenant has now lived in the property for 6 months. It's stabilized. I go to a bank. I use my credit now again. I refinance. I now have a loan. The debt to income argument, forget about creative finance. The argument is basically also saying, well, that person that just bought a property as a landlord, they can't go get another property because their debt to income ratio is now impacted. Mm. Is that true? It absolutely is not true. No, how is it the landlords are buying 8 properties, 10 properties, 12 properties? Well, doesn't the DTI, doesn't at some point their DTI get maxed out? No. What you do is you show proof of income. You show proof of payments being made by the other party, lease agreements, income statements. And then what does the lender do? The lender removes debt to income ratio off of the table. Mm-hmm. And they go, okay, cool. Yeah, we see that your property is being taken care of. You've got tenants in there for 2 years. We'll just wipe that out. So the way the national, okay, the national guidelines for lenders work is that once I buy a property from somebody subject to today, I show proof that I'm making payments, that lender can take 75% of that payment off their DTI today. After 12 months, 100% of that payment comes off of their DTI as I show proof that I've been making the payment. So no, I've never ran into a seller that could not get another loan. VA loans too. People go, oh, you're taking over their VA loan. I take over a lot of VA loans because the rates are obviously incredibly low. Pace, you're prohibiting somebody from getting a VA loan. I've never ran into that because VA entitlements, the average VA entitlement is $900,000. So what does that mean? It has VA loans have nothing to do with debt to income ratio. What they have to do with is the amount of entitlements that they get. So let's say I take over their house subject to on a $400,000 house. Guess what? The VA will still give them a loan for another $500,000 because it fits within their entitlements. And so it's just, it's an uneducated, inexperienced concern that people have. Same thing with me. I remember learning all of this stuff and I'm like, wait, hold on. Can you write this down on a whiteboard? Like, how does this actually work? I've been there too. I understand the skepticism. I truly, truly do. But when people come to me about that debt to income ratio, especially landlords, I'll get somebody from bigger pockets. They'll go, well, here's the DTI thing and you're hurting people. I'm like, so how many properties do you have? 10. Okay. Do you have loans on all of them? Yes. How did you get your second loan? Oh, I showed proof that the first house was being paid for by my tenants. I'm like, how is that any different on this situation? The seller shows that my servicing company, Westar Servicing is who I use, or Phase Servicing sometimes, is pulling money out of my account and they're distributing it to the bank account, the HOA, the this, the that. All of those payments are tracked for $24 a month. I pay a tracking company, a servicing company to do all of that for me. So when the seller goes to get a new loan, I just show them all the servicing documents and the lender gives them a new loan.
Makes sense. Real quick aside, yeah. I'm reading between the lines here. So you could say like, no, nothing, but nothing there. Bigger pockets. Net positive, net negative, net neutral on the real estate industry in general.
Oh, they're net positive for sure. I love Bigger Pockets. I love Bigger Pockets. I think our book is still their number one book that's ever launched. I love the collaboration I've had with them. But the challenge with Bigger Pockets is they've been so big, so they have a larger net. And so they attract people that are just kind of like brand new to the industry. And they also attract a very conventionally minded person that's like, I get my license, I become an agent, I go do the BRRRR strategy, loans are a great idea, doing 30% down payments and getting a 7% loan in 2024 is still viable. Like that's a lot of what they're teaching. And the reason being is because their audience is kind of just starting their journey and starting them on creative finance. I think Bigger Pockets that, you know, I think I have one of the most viewed podcasts with them. It's like 400,000 views. And a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, I can finally buy my first property. But I think Bigger Pockets believes that creative finance is like another level above traditional finance. So Bigger Pockets is absolutely a massive net positive for the industry for sure.
One more area of say skepticism or even just curiosity is maybe the business side of it. How scalable this is. You've scaled it, obviously. And I know you have a community, and I love how you talk about community, not audience, but community. So we can get into that if there's time. But how scalable is it for Joe Blow in, I don't know, Las Vegas, Nevada, or Boise, Idaho, to go out and do, you know, all these seller finance or all these creative finance deals, subject to deals? And what I mean by that is I'm picturing, you know, you've got, I don't know, 8, 10, 15, 20 different mortgages that you've taken over that you've done subject to financing with. You've got 20 different, maybe private money coming into these different deals, right? There's all these different JVs and terms and conditions. I know it is scalable, but maybe the better question is, how can somebody scale this without getting hurt or without hurting themselves? Or what's the most effective way to scale? Or what lessons have you learned as you've scaled?
The most effective thing is don't do traditional real estate because it's not scalable. That's the truth. I mean, the truth is people that are doing traditional real estate are going to a bank. They're begging the bank saying, hey, daddy bank, please give me some money. Bank says, sorry, your credit's not high enough. You need a cosigner. Okay, well, that's an element of non-scalability. Oh, you need a large down payment of 30%. And you know how many times when I've done the BRRRR strategy probably more times than most BRRRR educators have done the BRRRR strategy. When I do the BRRRR strategy, you know what's not scalable is like a week before I close on the refinance, my lender's like, oh, hey, you know, this is changing. The rate's going up a little bit, but hey, it's timed out. Also, we need another $7,000 at close, or hey, there's additional fees that we weren't telling you about because we didn't know this was going to happen. The title company, I look at traditional real estate, and all the non-scalable things about real estate are in traditional real estate. I have to have good credit. I have to have a W-2 that people will look at me, and I have a viable income that's steady. I mean, isn't it ironic that the people that are like, look, people that are real estate agents end up hating me because I say some things that really hurt their feelings. One of them being, guys, real estate agents don't own real estate. That's and real estate true. Agents very rarely actually invest do you know how many real estate agents own a single investment property? Less than 20% of them. Less than 30% of them own their primary residence. So why is that the case? It's because having 1099 income is not scalable when you're trying to invest in real estate if you're going through banks. Real estate agents can't even get a loan because they got to be an agent with steady income for 2 years, sometimes 3 years to get a loan. Yeah. I look at that, I'm like, how is that scalable? And more importantly, you can't take private money on a lot of these loans. They want you to have your own money that's seasoned in your bank account. Everything that is non-scalable in my mind is traditional real estate. So same thing with me. If I go take over 20 mortgages, I use a servicing company cost $24. They take care of all that stuff. So I'm not really dealing with any of those things. Same thing if I go buy 20 properties through the BRRRR strategy. I have to buy it. I have to season it through hard money. Then I have to refinance it. I'm doing two loans on one deal. I look at traditional real estate and I'm like, that's 10 times harder than what I do. 10 times harder.
At acquisition, that makes sense. I agree with you, yeah. Right? Like the ability for you to just acquire property and so right. on and subject to a creative financing method. You're right. No credit check, no tax history, nothing like that. It's easy to grab. Right. And this is because of my ignorance. I don't know. And maybe some of the folks that are asking this question. But downstream, you know, as you build a portfolio and you're managing and running that portfolio, are there not more stakeholders or moving parts down the road when you've got a fully creative finance subject to, maybe more specifically subject to portfolio versus, you know, this bank, I've got a portfolio product with them. It's on me. I'm paying the bank for all 12 of these mortgages. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Or I honestly not right or wrong. I don't know. Downstream, as you're managing this portfolio, are there not more moving parts or more complexities to managing a portfolio fully creatively financed?
I couldn't imagine what one complexity would even be. I see it's a valid concern for somebody who's never maybe done it.
Yeah.
But I look at it, I'm like, what is the complexity we're talking about that does not exist in traditional real estate?
Sellers. So you're still in bed with the sellers. Maybe it's just the
really. Sellers are talking about Christmas and Thanksgiving, but I'm not going through them. I'm not communicating to them about the house anymore. I'm the owner of the house. The payment goes to the bank. It doesn't go to the seller. So the seller's not receiving money ever again. I have a relationship with them because we're friends. We built rapport. But let's say that I don't build rapport with them and I'm doing all these deals and I would never talk to them. There's no conversation that ever happens with the seller after a subject to deal ever gets done.
Interesting. That makes sense. Ever. Yeah.
In a seller finance deal, yes. Like I'm paying the seller directly on my seller finance deal. So like I just bought an RV park up in Glacier, Montana, $5 million. The seller, Eric, gave me 5% down on a $5 million purchase, 4% interest, 40-year loan. I paid Eric directly. So my company, my girl who runs all my stuff, her name is Tony. Tony pays my sellers directly. But again, we still go through a servicing company. So all we do is set it up on automatic payments 5 days before the payment is due. Westar pulls the money out of our account and then distributes to taxes, insurance, seller note, all of those types of things. I don't see it as any more complex than anything else.
I think it may be feeling of weight of responsibility. Like to a bank, it's sort of an anonymous big institution. Yeah. But the weight of responsibility, like what if I fuck up?
I can see an argument there, yeah.
Right? You know, like what if I screw up? What if I miss a payment? What if I get sideways on something and now I'm directly impacting this human being, this individual? That might be it. But to your point, from a process standpoint, yeah, you're paying a mortgage every month, just like you would if
that's
you had
a really valid concern. I really like that. Now, I'm going to bring up a point on that it does not mean that I believe this, but think about this. When I go to a bank, guess what I'm getting? I'm getting a recourse loan. I'm getting a loan that if I fail on that loan, it's impacting my credit. I'm doing a lot of personal guarantees a lot of times with some of these commercial deals. Guess what I'm not doing in creative finance? I'm not doing any personal guarantees. I have non-recourse loans. None of these loans are even on my credit. And so if, let's say, the world implodes, right? People back in like 2007, 2008, the world falls apart. They get foreclosed on. There's short sales like crazy. All these investors are dumping their properties. It took them 7 years to rebuild their credit. Guess what? I have nothing that would ever hit my credit. Let's say Armageddon hits and nobody can make their payments and I can't cash flow on all these properties. I go, you know what? To hell with it. I just automatically became a big turd and I don't care about my responsibility to these sellers.
Sure.
I could walk away from all these loans today with no recourse. So there's an advantage there if you're a piece of crap. But the reality is you have a sense of duty to these homeowners and you have a sense of duty to the seller who sold something to you on seller finance, who says, the reason I sold this to you on seller finance is because you gave me the number I wanted. And more importantly, like, you have a very intelligent audience. So think about a seller that is wanting to retire. How does a seller who owns, let's say, 100-unit multifamily deal, how do they truly retire? Because guys, let's be honest, most operators of any asset are not really great operators. This is where the opportunity for us as real estate investors come in. We get a buy from tired landlords. So I go to that tired landlord. I say, hey, look, I want to show you how to retire from this 100-unit portfolio. I go, no, you know, our tax advisor says we have to do a 1031 exchange if we want to get out of this asset. I'm like, no, your tax advisor doesn't understand seller finance, because if you seller finance this to me, guess what you avoid? You avoid the capital gains tax. We can stretch that over 10, maybe even 15 years. We can make it to the point by the end of those 15 years, you've paid no capital gains tax, and I can give you the number you want. And more importantly, I can give you a monthly check with interest, 3%, 4%, 5% interest, that you're making money on your money, but you don't have to worry about the tenants, the trash, the taxes. Landlords are like, oh my gosh. And I go, we're going to upgrade you from the landlord to the lender. That's what we're going to do. Okay, now I have a sense of responsibility to that person, because guess what? That's their freaking retirement check. That monthly check is their retirement check. You are correct that that is a higher level of personal care besides me just paying some ominous, ambiguous, faceless bank a monthly payment versus somebody named Eric who just sold me this $5 million RV park. That guy receiving an $11,000 payment from me every month is actually how he pays his bills. So I could absolutely see that argument as a level of stress, but from a mechanic standpoint, I would say it's just as easy, if not easier.
You know, I like in that example I spoke of earlier with the multifamily where the son was jealous of the property, the 12-year-old son was jealous of the property. I believe you structured that 50 years of payments at $11,000 a month so that the 12-year-old at 62 is still getting paid by the building that he once hated. So that's the ultimate expression of love from dad.
Mario sold me 3 properties since that we did that deal, 3 different properties.
We had a little bit of time left. I want to dive into one or two more things if we can. On the today, from what I understand, you used to be a yellow letter guy. I think today you're looking more at expired listings. If that's still true, I'm not sure. But I wanted to ask about your funnel. So what does that look like? How many listings do you look at versus how many conversations you have versus how many offers you make versus, can you just take us down through that? Like, what's the, how much activity to get a deal?
Okay. My world now is very different than what it was obviously 10 years ago when I first started. Yeah. I was a yellow letter guy. I would spend $20,000 a month. I was doing a lot of wholesale, fixing and flipping and accumulating rentals at the same time. And I went through a phase of, phaseology, like we all do. All these, very confident ways I speak today, hate me or love me. I've gone through a lot of experience to become a different person than I was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I'm like, I'm afraid of owning rentals. There's a lot of responsibility with tenants and what if they don't pay? And I went through all of those things for years. And the way that I got through that is I just wholesaled a lot of these deals. That was $20,000 a month in marketing. And we would generate probably $150,000 a month in wholesale fees to pay for that marketing. And then I would pick and choose what houses I wanted to wholesale or a wholesale versus I fix and flip. And then I would pick one rental out of like 7 or 8 properties I saw, and I would start building my portfolio. That has now changed to the point where 90% of what I touch today just goes into the portfolio. Also, the biggest thing that's changed is my funnel. What I did about 5 years ago is I realized by helping other people, right? There's an alpha male right now listening to me talk that hates my guts. I know the demographic. I know what kind of people I upset. It's the territorial men that are like, oh, this guy's so cocky. Guys, I help more people for free than anybody I've ever met in my entire life. I started doing meetups 5 years ago. I know Daniel, you're doing, or Jamie, you're doing this too. Sorry, one of my favorite people I do deals with, his name's Daniel Graber. Your name's Jamie, sorry.
Jamie Gruber, yeah.
Yeah, Gruber. So that alpha male hates me because I seem like I'm cocky, I'm confident, and they don't understand the backstory of how I got here to this point. And I also understand we have limited time, so I talk fast, I speak confidently so we can get to the next topic. But if you spent time with me, you'd realize 5 years ago, I started doing meetups around the country because I got obsessed with helping somebody else get their first deal. And I did this for years and years. And I'm now at a point where 80% of the deals I touch and I buy are people that learned how to do this from me. So last year in our community, in our Discord channel, we did $9 billion in transactions subject to and seller finance. $9 billion. Now, some of those are businesses and planes and all that kind of stuff too, but primarily real estate. And I go in there and I go, hey guys, I'll buy that deal. Hey guys, I'll buy that deal. So my acquisition team is one guy versus 10 years ago, it was six. So I have a much smaller acquisition funnel. But what I've done is I said, why don't I just teach the masses how to do this? They'll go out, they can now be the person I was on the front end where I needed the wholesale fee to pay my bills. And so a lot of the deals that I buy now are people inside of my sub two community, 80%.
That's amazing. For the average guy then, the starting person who has to go out and, you know, in essence, door knock. I'm just kind of curious, the wholesaler versus
such the a subject. Great question. So let's say that I have a bomb strapped to my chest and it's that bomb says 10 hours or else I'm going to blow up. Okay. It's going to count down from 10 hours. I have 10 hours to get a deal. Otherwise the bomb's going to blow me up. Okay. What do I do? How do I get started? I have 10 hours. I have to get a deal. Here's what I do. I go buy Vulcan 7 software that real estate agents primarily use. And Vulcan 7 gives me active expired listings that pop up every single day. So in Maricopa County specifically, I'll get 40 new leads today. We'll get them at 8 o'clock. So it starts in 8 minutes. My team will get 40 new leads today. Those leads are sellers that just fired their 40 real estate agents for not being able to sell their house. We call that seller. We say, hey, again, saw that you listed with an agent, didn't work out well. I'm not an agent. We're not trying to get a listing. I'm sure you're getting 50 calls. We'd like to meet with you today to talk about giving you one of three options to sell your house to us. One, we'll give you a cash offer. It is going to be a lowball offer. Two, we'll give you a seller finance offer. Sometimes sellers don't know what that means. We go through and coach them on what that means. And then three, we'll give them an offer where we partner with them and flip the house and they make a portion of the profit if the house is in really bad condition. So we call that a novation agreement. So we'll give them three offers, 40 times a day. We'll submit offers to people. You could buy one deal your first day doing this, calling a seller directly. Here's kind of the math. The math is for every 100 conversations you have, you're going to buy one cash deal. You can wholesale it or flip it or burr it if you want. And then you'll buy one subject to or one seller finance deal.
In that same 100. So two out of 100, you'll get a cash deal and then a sub two creative finance deal.
Yep. So I look at it and I say creative finance doubled my efficiency so I can get a cash deal. Sometimes if I'm on the phone, here's what ends up happening. Out of those 100 deals, we get zero cash deals. We get only creative deals and there's four of them. So I'll double what my team can do. Obviously the efficiency is not there yet. And I'm so focused on solving their problem with creative finance that I don't even care about the cash offer anymore. But my team, obviously, in order for them to get commissions, they've got to get, you know, they got to get a cash deal so we can wholesale it and they make 20% of the commission. So 100 conversations over the phone using Vulcan 7 directly to the seller. You get 40 new leads every day in our market, depending on the market you're in. You'll get 20, 30, 40, 60 new leads every single day that you can call. They're fresh, right? These are people that just had a really hard conversation with their agent yesterday saying, please take my listing off the market. You failed. We are no longer in business. I call them the next day or the day after and we lock up a contract because obviously they were looking for a buyer for 6 months. That's like the target audience. Somebody who has been looking for a buyer for 6 months but failed to do so is one of the easiest, lowest hanging fruit you can ever go after.
Incredible.
You go after foreclosures, but the challenge with foreclosures, honestly, foreclosures is like a black belt strategy. Why? Because, and also some of the other things are black belt strategies. Like if I want to go after multifamily, I'm not going after foreclosure because if somebody's getting foreclosed on their commercial loan, I typically don't want to take over a commercial loan. They have short time frames. They have balloons in 2 years. I don't want to take over commercial loans typically that are in foreclosure. But if I'm going to go after large multifamily, what I do is I go to PropStream. I go pull a list of 25 years of ownership or more, somebody that only owns three assets or less. And we understand that person's self-managing. They've owned the property long enough that they've probably sucked out all the profit out of the deal. They've been living off the cash flow. They're somewhat retired. And now the property needs to be renovated. And they're like, I don't have any money because I've been sucking out all the money out of the property and going on vacations. Da, 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 da. So like the property we bought in Tucson, we bought this 4 months ago. Same thing. This guy's owned the property 40 years. So PropStream filter, really simple. Go to PropStream. Length of ownership, 25 years or more. Seller owns three assets or less in an LLC. Doesn't matter. One, I could have personal or LLC, but they have to own three assets or less. So two. I want them to own one more than one asset. So one or more. I'm sorry, two or more, three or less. So it's like either two or three. Very specific list. We call the seller. Hey, we can help you avoid capital gains tax. I can get you the number you want. I can take over the property and give you a monthly payment. That is a little bit more of a gangster strategy where you have to be good at negotiating. You have to understand taxes. You have to understand 1031s. But expired listings, if you want to start today, going after expired listings, those people have already told you they tried to sell for 6 months and they failed to do so. It is the easiest person to talk to. And you also don't have an agent that's the buffer between the two of you.
Makes sense. Couple minutes left. I want to ask this question. You've got three, I feel like, assets, big asset classes. You've got your real estate portfolio. You've got your business portfolio. You've got your community/audience. If you could only keep one, how to give the other two back, which one do you keep?
My community. And the reason being is my community is where I will buy four businesses this year. Last year, I bought $156 million in real estate just from my community. So you could delete all my portfolio and by the end of the year, I'd have another $100 million in real estate.
I asked Grant Cardone, your buddy, the same question. What do you think he said?
Audience.
No. He said I think his exact words were, ain't no one taking my fucking real estate. I think those were his exact words. So I was surprised.
I could see that, but also like, I know his team. I've been in his office 100 times. I know how they operate and they raise capital from his audience. So it's like,
I know
he's got his Reg A and he's got his Reg D and all that kind of stuff. Like he has raised all his money from his audience. And so I look at that. I'm like, you would take away your, he's ludicrous. Sometimes he says things that are just so silly. Like, oh, a single family home is not an investment. I'm like, you tell that to the homeowner that has $400,000 in equity, that wasn't the greatest investment that they've ever made in their life. His argument on that is valid for guys like you and guys like me, but it's not valid for 95% of the audience or 95% of the people in the United States. They should own their single family home. Their Betty Smith that works at Walmart as a Walmart greeter, tell her she should rent a property for the rest of her life. That's illogical, right? So sometimes he says things are a little bit silly because he has to be salacious and he has to, get people to think about stuff. There's no way you could convince that man to take his audience away. It took him 20 years to build that audience.
I had the same sense. And in fact, it was incongruent. If you really study the guy, which I do before interviews, it was incongruent with everything else that he said. Even being on Undercover Billionaire, one of the most difficult parts for him was when somebody didn't know who he was in that show.
Oh, yeah. Right?
So it didn't make sense, but you take the man at his word. So
that's not a problem for me. I'm not Grant. So I get recognized every day, but it's like somebody in real estate. Nobody outside of real estate knows who the heck I am.
Pace, I appreciate this, man. Where's the best place? Instagram?
Yeah, DM me on Instagram. I actually answer all my DMs. I spend an hour or so in the mornings and I just clear out all my DMs personally, voice memos. A lot of times I'll send videos answering people's questions, whatever questions you guys have. If you're a hater, okay, if you are a hater, you hate me, which typically happens when I get a 1 hour time frame because, Jamie, you did a great job researching and setting this interview up. But these typically you want to really get to know somebody. It's like a Joe Rogan podcast, like 2.5-3 hour podcast to truly understand somebody. But what we tried to do today is just jam pack tons of value, answering all the things in an hour. But if you guys have questions and you're a hater, please, I'll tell you a quick 30-second story. We got 1 minute left. And I got to jump on another podcast and do you. Yeah. So I have a guy, his name is Paul Carazon out of New York City. And he makes a post on Instagram about how he thinks I am full of crap. And there's no such thing as a no money down, 0% interest deal. It doesn't happen. He says, show me, show me, show me. So I don't look at him as with hate in my heart. I look at him, I go, that's a valid point that he makes. So what I do is I DM him and his team. I go, fly out to Arizona. I'll fly you out. You stay in my guest house. Let's hang out. I'll take you to my assets. I'll take you to all the places. I'll give you a tour of my office. Let's go hang out. Let's have dinner. I'll have my wife will make a dinner here. Bring your wife, bring your kids. So he does. He does. Okay. This is just literally last week. This happens all the time. People that hate me or make comments. The funniest thing happened. I'm interviewing Paul because now we're doing a podcast in my studio. I go, tell me about your first deal. Guess what kind of deal it was? No money down, 0% interest. He borrowed private money. And as I found this out, I go, hold on. Am I allowed to keep this on the recording that I can now show the rest of the world? He's like, oh my gosh, literally live on the podcast. He says, oh my gosh, I never realized that my first deal is a 70 unit apartment complex, no money down, no interest. And I borrowed private money and paid them back on a refi. Oh my gosh, what? Pace, I am so sorry. I have a book coming out that I say creative finance is bullshit. Should I delete that chapter? I go, no, leave it in there. Let the people be the haters. I love overcoming. So guys, if you're a hater, you don't like me, at least give Jamie some love, subscribe, make sure you guys, give them a great review. It does help out the podcast, but then come over and send me a DM and go, Pace, I'm a hater. Can I come and hang out with you for the day?
Amazing, Pace. I appreciate you, man. Thanks for this.
Yeah.